This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And this is James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we both welcome you back to another episode of The New World Next Week, which, of course, you can find on NewWorldNextWeek.com, where you can get the high-quality episodes. They look great if you can burn them off, and it really helps to spread, I think, this message around. So, folks, this is our 45th episode, and we are now just 9 days away from the 9th anniversary of 9/11. And it's amazing the timing sometimes of these kind of events. But just in the last few hours, and James, it's still September 1st to me, but it's already September 2nd to you in Japan. So I haven't really had time to digest this story. This is pretty new to me, but we're going to take it from 911blogger.com. International Center for 9/11 Studies secures release of thousands of photos and videos from NIST. The International Center for 9/11 Studies has secured the release of hundreds of hours of video footage and tens of thousands of photographs used by the National Institute of Standards and Technology for its investigation of the collapse of the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7. This material is being released to the center under the Freedom of Information Act in response to a lawsuit the center filed against NIST. Center filed a FOIA request with NIST on January 26, 2009, seeking production of, quote, all of the photographs and videos collected, reviewed, cited, or in any other way used by NIST during its investigation of the World Trade Center building collapses, end quote. Following several unsuccessful attempts to get NIST to even acknowledge receipt of the request, the center was forced to file a lawsuit on May 28, 2009. Shortly after the lawsuit was filed, this request was finally assigned a reference number, and NIST began periodically releasing batches of responsive records. To date, the center has received over 300 DVDs and several external hard disk drives that contain responsive records, more than 3 terabytes of data so far, and NIST has indicated that additional records will be released in the future. Now, this goes on, and this 9/11 blogger posting goes over just some of the first few videos that the center has started to go through. So again, this is terabytes of information. So James, let's get your take on this story and how much information we're probably going to be able to find in this.
Right. Well, first, of course, this is another example of people taking Freedom of Information Act requests and getting an incredible treasure trove of data through that. So people who recently heard my interview with Aidan Monahan might recognize this coming out to the fore again. So my hat's off to everyone who's out there getting this type of information through these FOIA requests. But as for this particular data set that they've managed to uncover, 3 terabytes of data is incredible. And of course, we're all looking forward to, I guess, sinking our teeth into the meat and potatoes when it's finally released, and people should take a look at 911datasets.org, where I guess eventually this will all be put up as a downloadable BitTorrent, and there will be different ways of getting this information. But suffice it to say, just the first few videos that they've posted up are already extremely interesting. Some interesting videos of the collapses, and especially of explosions and things happening right before the collapses. There's also some visual and some audio, I guess, segments of interest. And one of the things that I found interesting was that there are a few videos of the WTC-7 collapsing that seem to have been edited by NIST to actually exclude the moment of the initiation of the collapse. So there's a couple of videos where it's a stationary shot and the camera will be taking the building and then it suddenly cuts to the building already starting to fall. So there's definitely been some editing going on, and there's even a couple of videos where the audio of the collapse is missing, but then the audio kicks in after the collapse is finished, which is highly suspicious, to say the least, considering NIST's main position is that there is no evidence whatsoever for explosions. Well, how can we know that if they've edited out the audio or edited out the beginning of the collapse? So again, just extremely interesting things to take a look at, and I certainly hope people will take a look at this blogger post to start looking through the videos for themselves.
Absolutely. Well, and I think one of the comments already there does note that, well, and I'll first say that the center has said the things they're putting out is exactly how they've received them from NIST. They haven't edited them except to maybe take a smaller extract. But there was a comment that noted that, of course, light travels faster than sound, so you're going to see it before you hear it. So again, there's just a massive amount of information, and especially Building 7, And that ties in with, of course, all the things we know and don't know about the case of Barry Jennings. It also coincides with the buildingwhat.org campaign from NYCCAN.org, trying to get a commercial running to get folks asking the question, building what? So again, James, as we head into the 9th anniversary, and I know you have, again, as we've mentioned, you've got a massive 9/11 9th anniversary episode you're working on. And yeah, you just talked about the FOIAs and Aidan Monahan, and I think all of these things are ultimately good news.
I think so too. Ultimately, it shows that we are winning and we are prying out more information. And remember, I mean, it was over a decade before the public saw the Zapruder film with JFK, so there might still be that film out there that we haven't seen yet.
And of course, before we have to move to our second story, James, you and I would both note that we would also love to see, you know, tens of thousands of videos and hundreds of documents and terabytes of data also concerning the drills and the insider trading and the PTEC story, but perhaps we'll have to wait for that. So our second story, we're going to hop to the French agency press for a story that begins today here, first day of September, still in the States, predator drones to patrol entire U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S., beginning Wednesday, September 1st, will add a third predator drone to its border patrol with Mexico, allowing authorities for the first time to monitor the entire stretch of land separating the two neighbors using the unmanned craft. The latest drone joins two others in covering the 2,000-mile frontier, which runs across the states of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. With immigration a hot-button issue ahead of looming midterm elections in November, Obama earlier this month signed a $600 million bill aimed at reinforcing border security. His administration is seeking to step up security as it presses for comprehensive immigration reform measure that would allow many of the millions of illegal immigrants to be in the U.S. legally. Many Republican lawmakers say no immigration measure can be considered unless the federal government can ensure security along the southern U.S. border to prevent a spillover from Mexico's crime-ridden north and to prevent the arrival of more undocumented migrants. The U.S., which is deeply concerned by the raging drug war in its southern neighbor, deployed 1,200 National Guard soldiers and 1,500 new agents to the border in recent weeks, as provided for in this recent legislation. So we see the buildup, and we see this sort of amassing, and we're deeply concerned about the situation in Mexico, aren't we, James?
Oh, of course. Well, I think what we see here is some security theater, and it's well played for sure, because we know that those predator drones are very good for dropping bombs on scary brown people in foreign countries, so why not having them patrol the border? But ultimately, I'm going to make a bold prediction here that drugs are still going to continue to flow across the border, and so are illegal immigrants. So I don't think it's going to make any difference, and I don't think it's meant to make any difference other than for the optics.
I was going to say, because it's not like there's some larger agenda here at work, and they're playing both ends against the middle, as they enjoy doing in the grand chessboard style. Now, of course, James, in completely unrelated news, the new film Machete opens this Friday. So my worry, again, in watching the kind of media memes, and those are the things that kind of come together, about some kind of catastrophic, catalyzing attack on the border that, again, will kind of kickstart this agenda.
Well, it's something we have to keep in mind, and certainly the Machete fiasco has already been something of a psyop, so we'll have to keep our eye on that.
So for our final story, we'll move to foodworldorder.com for an article that originates from the Seattle Times, but thanks to gmwatch.org for the link. Gates Foundation ties with Monsanto under fire. For 2 years, local activists, now again, this is being out of Washington State, for 2 years, local activists on a shoestring budget have been trying to document connections between Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Monsanto, the company vilified by some for its heavy involvement in genetic engineering of crops. Try as they might, their work got little attention. That's all changed with the news reported by the Wall Street Journal last week that Monsanto was among the Gates Foundation's most recent portfolio investments. A filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission says the foundation bought 500,000 shares of the stock between April and June. And now that total value is estimated at $27.6 million. The Gates Foundation, of course, doesn't comment on specific investments, a spokeswoman said. While the Monsanto investment is a tiny fraction of the foundation's $33 billion endowment, it loomed large among those involved in food issues. The news ricocheted around activist circles and has given the Seattle-based Community Alliance for Global Justice a national platform. They're at seattleglobaljustice.org. Now, if we hop down the last couple paragraphs in this article, this is sort of the punchline for me as we're talking about the exposure of these elite groups and their connection to the eugenics agenda that are being exposed finally, thankfully, and thanks to Seattle Times and people doing work on this story. But the last couple paragraphs, we go to, of course, our expert. Elise Lufkin, Senior Program Director of Giving Assets Incorporated, a group that advocates socially responsible investing, said conflicts of interest usually arise when the programs a foundation funds are at cross purposes with the companies in which they're invested. An environmental organization opposed to oil drilling whose endowment benefits from oil company stocks, for example. So the Gates investment is not necessarily a conflict of interest if the foundation and Monsanto share the same goals. Conflict or not, the springboard for the national campaign to begin is this story. But the punchline for me, James, is if we look up Giving Assets Incorporated, and I've provided the link for you, the first place it goes, if you Google Giving Assets Incorporated, is to RockefellerFoundation.org. And they were giving $200,000 in the last several months to Giving Assets Incorporated. I like this, that it shows the sort of layer sometimes that, again, as we're exposing the obvious connections between eugenicists like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other eugenicists like the Monsanto Corporation, we cheer at the exposure of those connections, but then when we dig into the article, we see that there's still another controlled opposition that's still foundation funded, that still goes back to these same multi-generational serial killers.
That's right, and the final link that you put in that article is a link to Doomsday Seed Vault in the Arctic, yes, which is an article that I've already recommended several dozen times, so let's make it several dozen in one, because it's just such an important article that for people to read. So if anyone hasn't read it yet, please go to this link and please read it. It's such an important article to start to understand how the foundations tie in with this eugenicist agenda and how they're using biotech companies and seed companies to really corner the market for, well, food production and control over the populations. So it's very scary indeed, and I think there's a lot more to uncover with this story.
All right, I think that's going to do it for this week. So, James, on a lighter note, if I can mention quickly, I did just publish my fifth mixtape coming from MediaMonarchy.com. As some folks may or may not know, I come from a radio programming and DJ background, so I still love putting together music, and music still excites me. So mixtape number 5 is up. I call it Radio Sweetheart, and I think it's enjoyable because, as I note in there, it can't be news and politics all the time. On the other note, James, is it upcoming this weekend? You're about to drop your new episode?
I hope so, yeah, and start to look for it maybe to drop as early as Saturday or in installments on YouTube.
Okay. So many, many things coming out in installments and things, again, that we need to dig into more and start to do all our own research. And again, share the information with each other. That's, you know, to always cite the allegory of the cave, it's not enough to just find something out. You got to go and tell folks about it.
Well said. All right, James Impolotto, thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.